Chapter 4. Next to my Jensonian are my Gibbons, two editions, if you please, for my old complete one being somewhat crabbed in the print. I could not resist getting a set of Barry's new six-volume presentment of the history. In reading that book, you don't want to be handicapped in any way. You want fair type, clear paper, and a light volume. You are not to read it lightly, but with some earnestness of purpose and keenness for knowledge, with a classical atlas at your elbow, and a notebook hard by, taking easy stages and harking back every now and then to keep your grip of the past, and to link it up with what follows. There are no thrills in it. You won't be kept out of your bed at night, nor will you forget your appointments during the day, but you will feel a certain sedate pleasure in the doing of it, and when it is done you will have gained something which you can never lose, something solid, something definite, something that will make you broader and deeper than before. Were I condemned to spend a year upon a desert island, and allowed only one book for my companion, it is certainly that which I should choose. For consider how enormous is its scope, and what food for thought is contained within those volumes. It covers 1,000 years of the world's history, it is full, and good and accurate, its standpoint is broadly philosophic, its style dignified. With our more elastic methods we may consider his manner pompous, but he lived in an age when Johnson's turgid periods had corrupted our literature. For my own part I do not dislike Gibbon's pomposity. A paragraph should be measured, and sonorous if it ventures to describe the advance of a Roman legion, or the debate of a Greek senate. You are wafted upwards, with this lucid, and just spirit by your side upholding and instructing you. Beneath you are warring nations, the clash of races, the rise and fall of dynasties, the conflict of creeds. Serene you float above them all, and ever as the panorama flows past, the weighty measured unemotional voice whispers the true meaning of the scene into your ear. It is a most mighty story that is told. You begin with a description of the state of the Roman Empire, when the early Caesars were on the throne, and when it was undisputed mistress of the world. You pass down the line of the emperors with their strange alternations of greatness and profligacy, descending occasionally to criminal lunacy. When the empire went rotten, it began at the top, and it took centuries to corrupt the man behind the spear. Neither did a religion of peace affect him much, for, in spite of the adoption of Christianity, Roman history was still written in blood. The new creed had only added a fresh cause of quarrel and violence to the many which already existed, and the wars of angry nations were mild compared to those of excited sectaries. Then came the mighty rushing wind from without, blowing from the waste places of the world, destroying, confounding, whirling madly through the old order, leaving broken chaos behind it, but finally cleansing and purifying that which was stale and corrupt. A storm center somewhere in the north of China did suddenly what it may very well do again. The human volcano blew its top off, and Europe was covered by the destructive debris. The absurd point is that it was not the conquerors who overran the Roman Empire, but it was the terrified fugitives, who, like a drove of stampeded cattle, blundered over everything which barred their way. It was a wild, dramatic time, the time of the formation of the modern races of Europe. The nations came whirling in out of the north and east like dust storms, and amid the seeming chaos each was blended with its neighbor so as to toughen the fiber of the whole. The fickle Gaul got his steadying from the Franks, the steady Saxon got his touch of refinement from the Norman, the Italian got a fresh lease of life from the Lombard and the Ostrogoth, the corrupt Greek made way for the manly and earnest Mohammedan. Everywhere one seems to see a great hand blending the seeds. And so one can now, save only that emigration has taken the place of war. It does not, for example, take much prophetic power to say that something very great is being built upon the other side of the Atlantic. When on an Anglo-Celtic basis you see the Italian, the Hun, and the Scandinavian being added, you feel that there is no human quality which may not be thereby evolved. But to revert to Gibbon. The next stage is the flight of empire from Rome to Byzantium, even as the Anglo-Celtic power might find its center someday not in London, but in Chicago or Toronto. There is the whole strange story of the tidal wave of Mohammedanism from the south, submerging all North Africa, spreading right and left to India on the one side, and to Spain on the other, finally washing right over the walls of Byzantium until it, the bulwark of Christianity, became what it is now, the advanced European fortress of the Muslim. Such is the tremendous narrative covering half the world's known history, which can all be acquired and made part of yourself by the aid of that humble atlas, pencil, and notebook already recommended. When all is so interesting, it is hard to pick examples, but to me there has always seemed to be something peculiarly impressive in the first entrance of a new race onto the stage of history. It has something of the glamour which hangs round the early youth of a great man. You remember how the Russians made their debut, came down the great rivers and appeared at the Bosphorus in 200 canoes, from which they endeavored to board the imperial galleys. Singular that 1,000 years have passed, and that the ambition of the Russians is still to carry out the task at which their skin-clad ancestors failed. Or the Turks again. You may recall the characteristic ferocity with which they opened their career. A handful of them were on some mission to the emperor. The town was besieged from the landward side by the barbarians, and the Asiatics obtained leave to take part in a skirmish. The first Turk galloped out, shot a barbarian with his arrow, and then, lying down beside him, proceeded to suck his blood, which so horrified the man's comrades that they could not be brought to face such uncanny adversaries. So, from opposite sides, those two great races arrived at the city which was to be the stronghold of the one, and the ambition of the other for so many centuries. And then, even more interesting than the races which arrive are those that disappear. There is something there which appeals most powerfully to the imagination. Take, for example, the fate of those Vandals who conquered the north of Africa. They were a German tribe, blue-eyed and flaxen-haired, from somewhere in the Elbe country. Suddenly they too were seized with the strange wandering madness which was epidemic at the time. Away they went on the line of least resistance, which is always from north to south, and from east to west. Southwest was the course of the Vandals, a course which must have been continued through pure love of adventure, since in the thousands of miles which they traversed there were many fair resting places, if that were only their quest. They crossed the south of France, conquered Spain, and, finally, the more adventurous passed over into Africa, where they occupied the old Roman province. For two or three generations they held it, much as the English hold India, and their numbers were at the least some hundreds of thousands. Presently the Roman Empire gave one of those flickers which showed that there was still some fire among the ashes. Belisarius landed in Africa, and reconquered the province. The Vandals were cut off from the sea and fled inland. Whither did they carry those blue eyes and that flaxen hair? Were they exterminated by the Negroes, or did they amalgamate with them? Travelers have brought back stories from the mountains of the moon of a Negroid race with light eyes and hair. Is it possible that here we have some trace of the vanished Germans? It recalls the parallel case of the lost settlements in Greenland. That also has always seemed to me to be one of the most romantic questions in history, the more so, perhaps, as I have strained my eyes to see across the ice floes the Greenland coast at the point or near it, where the old Erbygia must have stood. That was the Scandinavian city, founded by colonists from Iceland, which grew to be a considerable place, so much so that they sent to Denmark for a bishop. That would be in the 14th century. The bishop, coming out to his see, found that he was unable to reach it on account of a climatic change which had brought down the ice, and filled the strait between Iceland and Greenland. From that day to this no one has been able to say what has become of these old Scandinavians, who were at the time, be it remembered, the most civilized and advanced race in Europe. They may have been overwhelmed by the Esquimaux, the despised Skreeling, or they may have amalgamated with them, or conceivably they might have held their own. Very little is known yet of that portion of the coast. It would be strange if some Nansen or Peary were to stumble upon the remains of the old colony, and find possibly in that antiseptic atmosphere a complete mummy of some bygone civilization. But once more to return to Gibbon. What a mind it must have been which first planned, and then, with the incessant labor of 20 years, carried out that enormous work. There was no classical author so little known, no Byzantine historian so diffuse, no monkish chronicle so crabbed, that they were not assimilated and worked into their appropriate place in the huge framework. Great application, great perseverance, great attention to detail was needed in all this, but the coral polyp has all those qualities, and somehow in the heart of his own creation the individuality of the man himself becomes as insignificant and as much overlooked as that of the little creature that builds the reef. 1,000 no gibbons work for one who cares anything for gibbon. And on the whole this is justified by the facts. Some men are greater than their work. Their work only represents one facet of their character, and there may be a dozen others, all remarkable, and uniting to make one complex and unique creature. It was not so with Gibbon. He was a cold-blooded man, with a brain which seemed to have grown at the expense of his heart. I cannot recall in his life one generous impulse, one ardent enthusiasm, save for the classics. His excellent judgment was never clouded by the haze of human emotion, or, at least, it was such an emotion as was well under the control of his will. Could anything be more laudable, or less lovable? He abandons his girl at the order of his father, and sums it up, that he eyes as a lover, but obeys as a son. The father dies, and he records the fact with the remark, that the tears of a son are seldom lasting. The terrible spectacle of the French Revolution excited in his mind only a feeling of self-pity, because his retreat in Switzerland was invaded by the unhappy refugees, just as a grumpy country gentleman in England might complain that he was annoyed by the trippers. There is a touch of dislike in all the allusions which Boswell makes to Gibbon, often without even mentioning his name, and one cannot read the great historian's life without understanding why. I should think that few men have been born with the material for self-sufficient contentment more completely within himself than Edward Gibbon. He had every gift which a great scholar should have, an insatiable thirst for learning in every form, immense industry, a retentive memory, and that broadly philosophic temperament which enables a man to rise above the partisan and to become the impartial critic of human affairs. It is true that at the time he was looked upon as bitterly prejudiced in the matter of religious thought, but his views are familiar to modern philosophy, and would shock no susceptibilities in these more liberal and more virtuous days. Turn him up in that encyclopedia, and see what the latest word is upon his contentions. View upon the famous 15th and 16th Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.